This is day two of this February 2014 two-day session. And I'm going to continue with this book of talks by Joko Beck. I don't think I mentioned the title of it yesterday. It's called Everyday Zen. Everyday Zen, Love and Work. I think it was the first of the first book of her talks that they put out. And I'm going to start with a section that's entitled Practicing This Very Moment. And she says, I'd like to talk about the basic problem of sitting. Whether you've been sitting a short time or for 10 years, the problem is always the same. When I went to my first sesshin many years ago, I couldn't decide who was crazier, me or the people sitting around me. It was terrible. The temperature was almost 105 degrees every day of the week. I was covered with flies, and it was a noisy, bellowing sesshin. I was completely upset and baffled by the whole thing. But once in a while, I'd go in to see Yasutani Roshi, and there I saw something that kept me sitting. Yasutani Roshi was Roshi Kaplow's teacher. He's one of three teachers he studied with in Japan, the last one. And Yasutani came here to Rochester back in the mid-60s. But he did a lot of sesshins also out in California, which is where Joko Beck sat with him. She says, unfortunately, the first 6 months or a year of sitting are the hard ones. You have to face confusion, doubts, problems, and you haven't been sitting long enough to feel the real rewards. It's so touch and go, getting a sitting practice established. Not just the first 6 months or a year, it's so hard to know, looking from the outside, who's going to keep at it, who isn't. It's hard to know why we ourselves kept at it. Can't figure out why I couldn't find a way to wriggle out, but here I am. And make the best of it, I guess. But the difficulty is natural, even good. As your mind slowly goes through all of these things as you sit here, confusing and ridiculous as it may seem, you're learning a tremendous amount about yourself, and this can only be of value to you. Please continue to sit with a group as often as you can and see a good teacher as often as you can. If you do that, in time, this practice will be the best thing in your life. Yeah, I'll second that. It doesn't matter what our practice is called, following the breath, shikantaza, koan study. Basically, we're all working on the same issues. Who are we? What is our life? Where did we come from? Where do we go? It's essential to living a whole human life that we have some insight. So first, I'd like to talk about the basic task of sitting, and in talking about it, realize that talking is not it. Talking is just the finger pointing at the moon. In sitting, we are uncovering reality, Buddha nature, God, true nature. Some call it big mind. Words for it that are particularly apt for the way I want to approach the problem tonight are this very moment. The Diamond Sutra says, the past is ungraspable, the present is ungraspable, the future is ungraspable. So all of us in this room, where are we? Are we in the past? No. Are we in the future? No. Are we in the present? No, we can't even say we're in the present. There's nothing we can point to and say, this is the present. No boundary lines that define the present. All we can say is, we are this very moment. And because there's no way of measuring it, defining it, pinning it down, even seeing what it is, it's immeasurable, boundless, infinite. It's what we are. people so glibly say, just be in the present. So much easier to say than to do. And here she is saying the same thing. Now, if it's as simple as that, what are we all doing here? I can say this very moment. That sounds easy, doesn't it? Actually, it's not. To really see it is not so easy, or we wouldn't all be doing this. Why isn't it easy? Why can't we see it? And what is necessary so that we can see it? Let me tell you a little story. Many years ago, I was a piano major at Oberlin Conservatory. It's actually the college I went to, Oberlin College, and the conservatory is half of it. She says, I was a very good student, not outstanding, but very good. And I wanted very much to study with one teacher who was undoubtedly the best. He'd take ordinary students and turn them into fabulous pianists. Finally, I got my chance to study with the teacher. When I went in for my lesson, I found that he taught with two pianos. He didn't even say hello. He just sat down at his piano and played five notes. And then he said, you do it. I was supposed to play it just the way he played it. I played it, and he said no. He played it again, and I played it again. Again, he said no. Well, we had an hour of that, and each time he said no. In the next 3 months, I played about three measures, perhaps a half a minute of music. Now, I had thought I was pretty good. I'd played soloist with little symphony orchestras. Yet we did this for 3 months, and I cried most of those 3 months. He had all the marks of a real teacher, that tremendous drive and determination to make the students see. That's why he was so good. And at the end of 3 months, one day he said, good. What had happened? Finally, I had learned to listen. And as he said, if you can hear it, you can play it. All the marks of a real teacher. I think sometimes people wish that Roshi would indulge them more, be more discursive. Real teacher wants you to see, wants you to go directly into it. Real teacher is your ally. So many ways we can spin off and miss what's right in front of us. She said, what had happened in those 3 months? I had the same set of ears I started with. Nothing had happened to my ears. What I was playing was not technically difficult. What had happened was that I had learned to listen for the first time, and I'd been playing the piano for many years. I learned to pay attention. That was why he was such a great teacher. He taught his students to pay attention. After working with him, they really heard. They really listened. When you hear it, you can play it. And finished, beautiful pianists would finally come out of his studio. To really pay attention is a different world. There's no easy switch, even when we have managed to suddenly step across that line that we've made between ourselves and everything else. It's not easy to do. It's real. Don't have to even come to Kensho to learn to really pay attention. We have to have a drive to become one. Has to be some passion. Cannot be phoned in. It's frustrating. should be so easy. But we keep getting in the way. We're tripping over our own feet. There's no other way than to just go at it. You will find a way. She says, it's that kind of attention which is necessary for our Zen practice. We call it samadhi, this total oneness with the object. But in my story, that attention was relatively easy. It was with an object that I liked. This is the oneness of any great art, the great athlete, the person who passes well on the football field. You can tell she's not really a sports fan. The person who does well on the basketball court. Anybody like that who has to learn to pay attention. It's that kind of samadhi. Now that's one kind and it's valuable, but what we have to do in Zen practice is much harder. We have to pay attention to this very moment, the totality of what is happening right now. And the reason we don't want to pay attention is because it's not always pleasant. It doesn't suit us. As human beings, we have a mind that can think. We remember what has been painful. We constantly dream about the future, about the nice things we're going to have or are going to happen to us. So we filter anything happening in the present through all that. I don't like that. I don't have to listen to that. And I can even forget about it and start dreaming of what's going to happen. This goes on constantly, spinning, 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 always trying to create life in a way that will be pleasant, that would make us safe and secure so we feel good. It always goes on and it never works. Never works. She says, when we do so, when we do that, we never see this right here now, this very moment. We can't see it because we're filtering. So important to realize this, to see that we're doing it. People don't realize that they're doing it. The great things about Zazen is you get to see the mind in action. You get to see the thoughts that you live with and normally aren't even aware of. We need to see this. There's so many subtle thoughts and attitudes and reactions that you can miss, even doing Zazen. You can be spinning off, deflecting your attention from the koan or the breath with the same preferences, the same aversions, again and again until you finally start to see it. Once you see it, you have a chance to drop it. Can't do practice mechanically. Can't just repeat the koan like a mantra. We can't see it because we're filtering. What's coming in is something quite different. Just ask any 10 people who read this book. You'll find they all tell you something different. They'll forget the parts that didn't quite catch them, they'll pick up something else, and they'll even block out the parts they don't like. Even when we go to our Zen teacher, we hear only what we want to hear. Being open to a teacher means not just hearing what you want to hear, but hearing the whole thing. And the teacher is not there simply to be nice to you. We not only miss what other people are saying to us, we miss what we're saying ourselves. It's remarkable how often we say something and don't even know we said it. The crux of Zazen is this. All we must do is constantly to create a little shift from the spinning world we've got in our heads to right here now. That's our practice. The intensity and ability to be right here now is what we have to develop. We have to be able to develop the ability to say, no, I won't spin off up here, to make that choice. Moment by moment, our practice is like a choice, a fork in the road. We can go this way, we can go that way. It's always a choice, moment by moment, between our nice world that we want to set up in our heads and what really is. And what really is at a Zen sesshin is often fatigue, boredom, and pain in our legs. What we learn from having to sit quietly with that discomfort is so valuable that if it didn't exist, it should. When you're in pain, you can't spin off. You have to stay with it. There's no place to go. So pain is really valuable. We have to develop faith in what Joko is saying, in the value of being present in this moment. It can seem like that's not it, because clearly I'm in the moment and it's boring and I'm distracted. That's not what I'm looking for. It's not here. It's like that story about the drunk, somebody came across him stumbling around, rooting through the bushes underneath the streetlight, and they said, what are you doing? What are you doing? I'm looking for my car keys. Oh, really? Really? You know where you dropped them? Yeah, I dropped them over there. Well, then why are you looking here underneath the streetlight? Well, the light's better. Our Zen training is designed to enable us to live comfortable lives, but the only people who live comfortably are those who learn not to dream their lives away, but to be with what's right here now, no matter what it is. Good, bad, nice, not nice, headache, being ill, being happy, it doesn't make any difference. One mark of a mature Zen student is a sense of groundedness. When you meet one, you sense it. They're with life as it's really happening, not as a fantasy version of it. And of course, the storms of life eventually hit them more lightly. If we can accept things just the way they are, we're not going to be greatly upset by anything. And if we do become upset, it's over more quickly. It's always remarkable when someone is in extremis, facing death, for instance, and they're just there with it. It's inspiring. It's truly a mark of practice. Some people who have that ability, who never have heard of Zen, but they've learned to be with their lives. Storms of life are going to hit all of us. She says, let's look at the sitting process itself. What we need to do is to be with what's happening right now. You don't have to believe me, you can experiment for yourself. When I am drifting away from the present, what I do is listen to the traffic. I make sure there's nothing I miss, nothing. I just really listen. And that's as good as a koan because it's what's happening this very moment. We have the breath. We have the koan. We have reality. What we don't want to do is to go off into our thoughts. Sometimes it's nice just to listen to the ticking of a clock. Remember reading, I think it was Harada Roshi, Roshi Kapo's first teacher, who was counseling someone on their deathbed and gave them as a practice just to listen. I'm not sure if it was him. It might have been a different Japanese teacher. Had a clock by the bed and said, "That's your practice. Just listen to the clock." And whoever it was actually came to awakening doing that. As Zen students, you have a job to do, a very important job, to bring your life out of dreamland and into the real and immense reality that it is. The job is not easy. It takes courage. Only people who have tremendous guts can do this practice for more than a short time. But we don't do it just for ourselves. Perhaps we do it first, that's fine, but as our life gets grounded, gets real, gets basic, other people immediately sense it, and what we are begins to influence everything around us. We are actually the whole universe. But until you see that clearly, you have to work with what your teacher tells you to work with. Have some faith in the total process. It's not only faith. It's something like science. Others before you have done the experiment, and they've had some results from that. About all you can do is say, "Well, at least I can try the experiment. I can do it. I can work hard." That's as much as any of us can do. The Buddha is nothing but exactly what you are right now. Hearing the cars, feeling the pain in your legs, hearing my voice, that's the Buddha. You can't catch hold of it. The minute you try to catch it, it's changed. I want to read here something from a Taisho that Tangen Roshi gave. Tangen Roshi, of course, was the Dharma heir of Harada Roshi, actually was adopted by Harada Roshi, and really a mentor and friend to Roshi Kaplow when he was in Japan at Hoshinji. The Tangen Roshi says, "What you think you are, who you think yourself to be, is so entirely mistaken. Grasping self, you obviously fail to see who you really are. You try to hold what cannot possibly be held, for where is there anything fixed? Change is swift. Because you try to hold on, you feel so much anxiety. It's inevitable. How could you know true satisfaction? Dissatisfied, you look restlessly out here, out there. Your base camp is I, me, mine. You grasp it. You seek to rely on it. You are relying upon a phantom. You grasp this phantom self and ceaselessly try to satisfy it. What lengths do we go through to gratify the self? We get what we want for a time, and then we lose it. Up, down, up, down. We try to rely on our clever thinking. How could there be any true peace of mind? How could you even begin to give to the great universe as you receive? Your compassion could only remain half-baked, locked as you are in I, me, mine. You are doing your practice because you have determined to receive life as it is, to come home to life. You will meet with true self." The faith of a great teacher. Each of us have this capability. And each of us begins to realize that self, even before some kind of breakthrough, some kind of official sanction. We begin, the boundaries of the self begin to soften. We find there's less in us that resists our life. All the sitting begins to add up, that effort, that painful effort, changes us. Once we begin to soften, once we begin to see our interactions with people changing, not getting stuck so much, then we have greater faith. We develop the determination to stick with it. We develop the ability to go through dry periods, which everyone experiences, to work through our fears. Not to spin off if we become bored, restless. Choko says, being what we are at each moment means, for example, fully being our anger when we are angry. That kind of anger never hurts anybody because it's total, complete. We really feel this anger, this knot in our stomach. We're not going to hurt anybody with it. The kind of anger that hurts people is when we smile sweetly and underneath we're seething. Often we're angry and we don't even know it, acting out of blindness. Once we know we're angry, we can be direct, can own it. So much more effective to say, I'm feeling a lot of anger here, than to say, you're not acting the way you should. You're not the way you should be. So much more effective to stick to what we know, that knot inside our stomach. Blood rushing to the face. Just to feel those things is a huge, huge step forward. When I was after I'd stopped drinking, going to AA meetings and trying to follow the 12 steps, there's one step that goes, when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. And I was in the middle of an argument with my wife and pretty angry. And realized that I was wrong. And was totally unwilling to admit it. The thought came up, I saw what I ought to do, and I did not for a minute want to lose that argument. But at least I saw it, and I like to think that later on, in some subsequent argument, I may have softened a bit. We have to see first. And in order to see, we have to pay attention. We can't spin off. She says, when you sit, don't expect to be noble. Don't expect to be noble. Don't be a romantic. When we give up this spinning mind, even for a few minutes, and just sit with what is, then this presence that we are is like a mirror. We see everything. We see what we are, our efforts to look good, to be first or to be last, to be first or to be last. We all have a place where we're comfortable. It's the most painful thing, I think, in my early practice was constantly comparing myself to other people. Feeling dismay if I thought someone else was doing well. Seems so ridiculous now, it's hard even to remember. It wasn't until I'd been gone a long time and came back that had passed. It's wonderful when other people are doing well. It's a tremendous support. It's an inspiration. They actually carry us. When I was young, I read some science fiction book. Can't remember who was the writer was or what it was, you know, much about it. But the hook in the story was basically that someone had been given one wish. Think by the devil. And, you know, he could wish for happiness or whatever. And He wished, without any change to myself whatsoever, I would like to become the most miserable, despicable person in the world. At which point the devil screamed because he was utterly boxed in and defeated. Anyway, I thought that was... That story stuck in my mind for a long time. We see our anger, our anxiety, our pomposity, our so-called spirituality. Real spirituality is just being with all that. If we can really be with Buddha, who we are, then it transforms. Shibayama Roshi once said in Sesshin, "This Buddha that you all want to see, this Buddha is very shy. It's hard to get him to come out and show himself." Why is that? Because the Buddha is ourselves, and we'll never see the Buddha until we're no longer attached to all this extra stuff. We've got to be willing to go into ourselves honestly. When we can be totally honest with what's happening right now, then we'll see it. We can't just have a piece of Buddha. Buddhas come whole. Our practice has nothing to do with, oh, I should be good, I should be nice, I should be this or that. I am who I am right now. And that very state of being is the Buddha. I once said something in the Zendo that upset a lot of people. I said, to do this practice, we have to give up hope. Not many were happy about that. But what did I mean? I mean that we have to give up this idea in our heads that somehow, if we could only figure it out, there's some way to have this perfect life that's just right for us. Life is the way it is, and only when we begin to give up those maneuvers does life begin to be more satisfactory. Have to let T.S. Eliot weigh in here. He wrote, "I said to my soul, be still and wait without hope. For hope would be hope for the wrong thing. Wait without love, for love would be love of the wrong thing. There is yet faith, but the faith and the love are all in the waiting. Wait without thought, for you are not ready for thought. So the darkness shall be the light, and the stillness, the dancing." Three most famous words in Zen, I don't know. If you know, how can you possibly be surprised? How can you possibly ever see? She says, I say to give up hope. I don't mean to give up effort. As Zen students, we have to work unbelievably hard. But when I say hard, I don't mean straining an effort. It isn't that. What is hard is this choice that we repeatedly have to make. And if you practice hard, come to a lot of sesshins, work hard with a teacher, if you're willing to make that choice consistently over a period of time, then one day you'll get your first little glimpse. This first little glimpse of what this very moment is. And it might take 1 year, 2 years, 10 years. It might take 20 years. Might take 30 years. Now that's the beginning. That one little glimpse takes a tenth of a second. But just that isn't enough. The enlightened life is seeing that all the time. It takes years and years and years of work to transform ourselves to the point where we can do that. I don't mean to sound discouraging. She's so mean. You might feel you probably don't have enough years left to do it, but that's not the point. That's not the point. At every point in our practice, it's perfect. And as we practice, life steadily becomes more fulfilling, more satisfactory, better for us, better for other people. But it's a long, long continuum. As Dogen said, there's no end to practice and beginning to enlightenment. There's no end to enlightenment beginning to practice. Awakening is not an end point. People have some silly idea that they're going to be enlightened in 2 weeks. Already we are the Buddha. There's just no doubt about that. How could we be anything else? We're all right here now. Where else could we be? But the point is to realize clearly what this means, this total oneness, this harmony, to be able to express that in our lives. That's what takes endless work and training. It takes guts. It's not easy. It takes a real devotion to ourselves and to other people. Now, of course, as we practice, all these things grow, even the guts. This is so true. Our courage, our determination, this all develops along with our practice. Everything comes together. The whole process is natural and it's not under our control. And Roshi says, trust the process. We have to sit with pain and we hate it. I don't like it either. But as we patiently just sit our way through that, something builds within us. Working with a good teacher, seeing what she or he is, we are slowly transformed in this practice. It's not by anything we think, not by something we figure out in our heads. We're transformed by what we do. And what is it that we do? We constantly make that choice. We give up our ego-centered dreams for this reality that we really are. We may not understand it at first. It may be confusing. When I first heard talks by teachers, I'd think, what are they talking about? But have enough faith just to do your practice. Sit every day. Go through the confusion. Be very patient. And respect yourself for doing this practice. It's not easy. Anyone who sits through a Zen session is to be congratulated. I'm not trying to be hard on you. I think people who come to this practice are amazing people. But it's your job to take that quality you have and work with it. We're all just babies. The extent to which we can grow is boundless. And eventually, if we're patient enough and work hard enough, we have some possibility of making a real contribution to the world. In this oneness that we finally learn to live in, that's where the love is. Not some kind of a soupy version, but a love with real strength. We want it for our lives, and we want it for other people's lives. We want it for our children, our parents, our friends. So it's up to us to do the work. So that's the process. Whether we choose to do it is up to us. The process may not be clear to many of you. It takes years before it becomes clear so that you really know what you're doing. Just do the best you can. Stay with your sitting. Come to Sesshin. Come to sit. Let's all do our best. It's really important. This total transformation of the quality of human life is the most important thing we can do. And it's a privilege to do it. It's so remarkable to have people come together, do this practice, which can be very painful, which requires so much of us. We know we need to give 100%, and that's so hard to do. All we can do, as Joko says, is just make that choice. Catch ourselves and come back. Don't have to make ourselves think in some special way. There's no contortions needed. Even though it's difficult, it's totally, totally simple. Stop now and recite the four vows.